welcome everybody, those of you who are here and those of you who are listening somehow online through our podcast. This is our inaugural Brock University Applied Disability Studies podcast, and we're very, very pleased to have some exceptional speakers tonight. And a few things that I want to start out by saying is our focus tonight is on private practice and behavior analysis and how to do it and be successful. So we're hopeful that this is a topic that's timely and of interest to everyone that's listening. I also want to thank Dr. Allison Cox for all the work that she did in organizing the podcast this evening. And I also want to thank our host, Monarch House, for having us on site. Thank you for that. And I'm actually going to let our guests introduce themselves briefly, and then we'll dive right in. And perhaps we'll start with the person that's closest to me, to my right, and we'll work our way all the way to the farthest, which is in Manitoba. So I'll turn things over.
My name is Mary Phillips, and I'm the clinical director at a new center called the Discovery Center, actually just down the road in Oakville. So we just opened in September, and we had expanded from a previous company that was just home-based. And before that, I did some behavioral consultation with adults for a couple of years. And before that, I was in IBI and ABA at a few different agencies. So I've been overall in the field for about 13 years.
Thank you very much. And we'll keep moving.
And my name is Tracy Lindblad, and I'm the clinical director of Monarch House here. For Eastern Canada, and I started out as a speech and language pathologist working in school boards for the first 10 years of my career, and then I went into private practice as a speech pathologist, and I did that and picked up ABA along the way. Did that for about 20 years, still working in private practice as a private business. So was a speech pathologist in private practice, became a behavior analyst, did that in private practice, and and continue to do that. So thank you for having me.
You're very welcome. And online.
I'm Kirsten Worth. I'm a registered psychologist and a board certified behavior analyst doctoral. I'm in private practice. It's been almost 5 years. And before that, I was with St. Amant, which is the largest agency providing behavioral services in Manitoba. I was the clinical manager for the autism programs there for both like EIBI programs and in preschool and school age, and a behavior analyst for the residents who lived there before that. And I'm an adjunct professor at the U of M as well.
Excellent. Thank you so much. What we're hoping to do is do a little bit of a round robin of questions. We'll start with some that we were given and asked to share with our presenters. And we also have people in the audience here who may ask some questions as well. And it's nice to see that we have a pretty diverse background in terms of length of time in private practice. Some people creeping up, if I'm doing the math correctly, creeping up to like 30 years in private practice. Some who are kind of going through some of the earlier challenges. So I think you've got some great people to pull from. The first question I'm going to pose to everyone is, what motivated each of you to pursue private practice? And I'm actually going to start this time with Tracy.
So what motivated me for private practice was that I was an employee, a speech language pathologist in the school board, and I had developed a niche area. I really was interested. And we're talking the late 80s about autism. So there were very few individuals in the school boards. It was like 3 individuals per 10,000 children at that time. And so because I took an interest in it and I had a background in alternative and augmentative communication, people were quite willing for me to see those children and travel out throughout the school boards. So I started with a couple of colleagues, the board-wide autism teams in both Peel and Dufferin Peel boards. And so because I had developed that niche, I wanted to have some flexibility in furthering my competency in the area. I wanted to undertake some different activities that I couldn't do at the school board. Things like presenting at conferences, conducting applied research that, you know, they just limited those things. I wanted to work across a number of different settings, so not get pigeonholed into a setting. And I wanted to work more collaboratively with other professionals. So that's what spurred me into private practice. initially.
Excellent. And Kirsten, how about you? What motivated you?
I would say it was a little bit more self-serving than Tracy's foray into private practice. But essentially, I was with St. Amant for 14 years, and I had the great benefit to work under a couple of really, really good behavior analysts. And they both retired. And with the and one of them was the president and CEO of the organization. So with that change came a complete switch, I guess, in philosophy and direction the organization was moving in, and a great reduction in my flexibility as a manager to provide services the way that I always had. And at that time, I just didn't feel like there was any further reason for me to stay. And I thought that given the state of the wait list for services in Manitoba, which at that time was, 12 months or more, for kids under five, and for kids over five, there was no wait list because they just weren't eligible at all. I thought that I would easy peasy go into private practice. I already had a name in the community. And I learned a lot of things after that.
And thank you for that, Kirsten. I enjoy that you said you were just going to easy peasy go into private practice. So I think we'll probably get to talk a bit more about how easy peasy it really is. But I'm going to ask Mary if she'll jump in and talk about what motivated her to pursue private practice.
Sure. So I had, as I said, had a number of years of experience at a couple of different providers in IBI and ABA. And then I had kind of a personal life change in moving cities. And I was on mat leave at the time and looking for some different experiences. And an opportunity came up to do behavior consultation with adults through Prior Linder and Associates. And that was really an exciting opportunity for me because I hadn't done much work there. And there was also an affiliated company, Autism Behavior Habilitation Services, that was, as I said, doing home-based services for kids. So I got involved in that as well and kind of over those years realized that I missed being with the kids for the majority of my time. And although home-based services are great for many different reasons. I loved the idea of a center, and for IBI, I think it's best. And the timing and the opportunity came up to propose opening a center, the Discovery Center. So I was really excited to kind of work on it from the ground up and develop a culture of training and mentorship for ITs and develop relationships with families and all those things that we love to do as BCBAs. And it was an exciting and very unknown thing to undertake, so that's what motivated me.
It's interesting because you all had different reasons and some overlaying themes. But each of you were identifying professional goals to some degree, whether it was wanting to embed more training and mentorship, whether it was wanting to expand your own experiences, to do different things, whether it was because you felt like the position didn't allow you to do things to the level of quality that you wanted. So it sounds like each of you have very, very specific kind of goals that you were aiming towards. When you started in private practice, what was step one for you? Or alternatively, what do you think step one should be now that you look back? And maybe we'll start, I think I started with you last time. So Kirsten, how do you feel about jumping in and answering that question? What's step one in venturing out in private practice?
I had trouble thinking about how to answer this question because I would say there's 100 first steps to take. And so I don't know if I'm answering a few questions, but maybe I'll start with just highlighting some of the things that I did, because that wait list that I expected to have very quickly. And because just because the need is there and people are desperate and they want the services doesn't mean that they are going to pay for it. And I think especially in Canada, because, and especially in Winnipeg, I don't know if it's different, you know, where you guys are, but in Winnipeg, we're very cheap and and we're known for that. And if people think that they're going to get something through healthcare, or they should get it, or they might get other services, and they don't quite understand the value of what's evidence-based versus what isn't, they're certainly not going to be lining up to pay for it, and to invest the amount of time and energy and everything that goes into an EIBI program. So I learned that kind of the hard way, and I had to be creative in terms of developing a lot of partnerships, networking, developing mentorships, figuring out who the right people were that I needed to get my information out to, that would provide the most number of referrals. Because honestly, I thought it was going to be St. Amant. I thought that it made the most sense that the place that had the largest wait list would be the only public service that was available in Manitoba. And actually, they were very tight-lipped about sharing private information because they felt that as a public service that they couldn't take the position of sharing that with families, that as individuals they could. But it got confusing for a lot of the staff, even a lot of my colleagues. And so they kind of took to really not sharing that information. So I ended up having to find other ways. So I started offering presentations to parents for free or at low cost. I started meeting with various pediatric groups and doing lunch and learns for them on specific topics and why, you know, behavioral expertise is valuable and really important. And that's a group that values evidence-based information. So that's been really helpful. And I have to keep doing that every year because every time I do it, I get a flurry of referrals and then they kind of drop off over the course of the year. And then I do it again and then I'm back up to the flurry of referrals. So, and then also discovering the different publicly funded agencies like Child and Family Services, where they really need behavioral services and they don't get to access here anyways, they don't get to access children's disability services because they're through a different system. And so they often will contract out for a ton of different private services. So finding networking and finding out, you know, who should have your information and who would be the best source of referral is a little bit of trial and error. And that was probably the biggest thing that I focused on for the first couple of years.
I think it sounds to me like your first step might have been to create a list of the 100 things you need to do, Kirsten.
Yeah.
And I appreciate hearing you say that not only did you have to kind of identify and develop a referral base, you actually had to educate them. So you couldn't really take for granted that people were
yes.
just going to start coming to you.
Absolutely.
Yeah. All right. I will ask Mary what her kind of first step would be.
Sure. It's pretty in the recent past. So I'll just speak to the kind of the practical steps that I took. So I had a team that were supporting me and opening the center. And so my first step for them was to develop a business plan around opening the center and doing some research around agencies that are in the area and what the market seems like, you know, how many agencies have wait lists, how many agencies have wait lists that are closed, all those kinds of things. And then trying to determine based on, you know, the standard pricing in the province, what would be an appropriate fee for clients, what's kind of the going rate for instructors, all those kinds of things. And then coming up with a projected 5-year plan and ideas about where would be a good location and what our service model would be, because my previous experience had been you know, full-time kids, and that was kind of it, right? They all came 9 to 3, that was it. So you had a bit nice, like all the instructors worked 8:30 to 4:30. And then now there's a lot more flexibility that's required in offering services. I think a lot of families have, you know, more desire to be part-time and part-time in school or having ABA after school. So it was kind of a question about do we want to set really strict limits right away or have more flexibility? And so in flexibility, it's great because you might be able to get more clients, but then in terms of having ITs and scheduling, I'm not going to lie, I spend like a million hours scheduling, trying to pick where everyone is. And as Kirsten kind of said, your to-do list is 100 items long. And I would say I am continually adding to that to-do list, even now being in the first year. And then also trying to get my head around government funding, which then 6 months later, everything went out the window. So that's been an ongoing learning curve as well, trying to manage that. And then working on marketing and getting referrals, as Kirsten said. And I would say, you know, it's still a pretty small field. And, you know, talking to old people that I've worked with, getting advice from old bosses. And then when you, you know, get those first clients, word of mouth has been a big factor for me in terms of getting additional referrals. So I could go on and on, but I think those were the first few steps. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's great that you commented on starting with a business plan. I think as people who are trained as clinicians, we all mm-hmm. hate talking about business. I had a mentor who told me once that you can't do good work if you don't do good business. And I think that's a philosophy that people are going to have to embrace in this province right now, that you have to start with a plan, you have to figure out how you're actually going to pay your staff, how you're going to have a building for children to come to. And so I think that's helpful. And the fact that you commented on reaching out to mentors and looking to have them guide you. Tracy?
Yeah, so the step one, really venturing into private practice, and my advice would be don't do it. Step one, be an employee if you can first. You don't know what you don't know. And you don't even know, I think some of you who may have never worked in a real agency, you don't really realize what's required into actually providing business services. So all those little things that you take for granted, suddenly they're not there and it's up to you, and you have to be able to identify some of them. So my first step actually was to do a business plan. And luckily, I have a husband who was in banking at that time, and so pointed me to the CanadaBusiness.ca website that has all free templates for business plans. And he was my sort of like in-home professor to translate all the vocabulary, because, you know, you've just learned vocabulary for behavior analysis, but now that's not enough. If you're going to be in private practice, you have to learn all the business language, and that's the language they speak. So you need to figure that out. So I did a business plan, and I mean, I actually just found it. Back then it was on typewriter and paper and pencil. It was not like it is now. But it's hilarious what I actually thought and how wrong I was. I was so wrong about how easy it was going to be. Same with, like what Dr. Worth said, you know, people would be lined up. And it was speech pathology that I was in. And I was an early adopter. So at that time, there were only about 2% of speech pathologists that were in private practice. And there are thousands of speech pathologists in Ontario, but I was going to do this. But I think looking back and looking at where we are now in the province and looking at where you people are and thinking about private practice, I would say if you can even get a part-time job to give you some stability while you try out, you test out your feet in private practice. It is not for the faint of heart. It is not a straight line graph like in skill acquisition. I don't even know if it'll take you a long time to get a trend line. You need to do your business plan and call on others to help you about what's realistic in your business plan. I think the other thing that really helped me, and probably why I stayed in private practice so long, is there were about 10 of us that all decided at the same time, 10 speech pathologists, that we were going to do private practice all in the Halton region. We all had, we're colleagues, we liked each other, and we figured there were enough clients that we know, and people had different areas that had already scoped out that doing different things. So we figured out we could refer to each other and be support. So we call it the PPIG, the Private Practice Interest Group at the time. And we still talk to each other a lot. So it was our community of practice. It was our support group. We all spoke the same language. We all mentored each other. We all supported each other in areas that someone was really good in the accounting part of it. We actually held, for the first 5 years, we held summer conferences that we, in the end, even helped us in business, because we picked a venue, we had to negotiate all the contracts with them, and we invited, we opened it up to other people. And so in the end, if it could cover our registration and the speakers, we were happy. So it was kind of how we got our own professional development, but then picked those people that we needed. So the accountants, the lawyers, all the business people, the bankers, like all the people that we had never interacted with in our professional lives. The other thing that we did, though, is we looked to our provincial organization and our national organization, because one of the things private practice was just starting, and kind of like we are a bit now in behavior analysis, it was really important as a field that we didn't undercut our field, that we didn't do damage to our field. That, yeah, we were all fighting for business, and most people didn't have a lot of money for reimbursement for speech services. So it's the same thing. They don't want to pay, even though they need it. They, you know, and public services aren't great, never were for that. So, you know, we really wanted to make sure that we weren't going to set our rates that would undercut our value just to get clients. I did do, like Dr. Wirth, a lot of pro bono work at the beginning to get the name out, to do free workshops, but really we set our rates, and as a group we decided that we would support each other, and we didn't collude. We set our rates independently, but we set professional rates. And so I think that's something that, you know, it's going to be hard in the right now in this field to figure out what is that rate, especially that parents are currently weighing in on that as well. So I think, you need your combination of clinical and business expertise, as well as, I'll go beyond the 100, I think it's like 1,000 other things that you need to figure out in private practice.
And I think you're all saying there's so much more, even if you have a good business plan, even if you've had some experience beforehand, there's so much more that you're going to end up doing that you can't necessarily predict that continuously comes up. So either have a fabulous business plan or marry a banker is your other option as well. So my next question leading into that is really stemming from what you just said, Tracy. So maybe I actually will skip and jump to you. But private practice requires a combination of clinical and business expertise, as well as legal and jurisprudence knowledge. So how do you recommend BCBAs, especially early career BCBAs, learn about all of these areas?
So there's a lot more resources out there than you know. And so take a business course. The municipalities have business courses. The Canadian government, the federal and provincial governments have business courses that are free. So you can go to your local your government offices and take those business courses, and you're there with all kinds of different people, which is kind of a really good thing too, to hear what other people think about, because sometimes it will help you. The other thing I think is to build your team from the beginning with people that you can't afford. And it sounds kind of crazy, but you need a really good accountant and a really good lawyer. And I didn't do that initially because I'd had a lot of other people helping me. But in the end, I wish I had done it sooner, because they put you on the right path, and they get you need to know someone that you're consulting with needs to know all the laws. There's provincial laws, there's federal laws, there's regulation and acts in our province, and you have to meet them. Not knowing them, ignorance of the law is no excuse, and you can run into trouble. What I also did, though, to learn some of that stuff, is I actually went into business before I opened my private practice with a friend of mine, and we sold Fifth Avenue jewelry, which is So I don't even know if he's still out there. But it's like a home party thing. And she was going to be the salesperson, the home party person, not me. And I was going to do all the books because I needed to learn that accounting part and figure that all out. So for me, that was very helpful too. But I think in speech pathology, we were lucky as a regulated health professional. All the jurisprudence and your laws and your acts, are we had all that. We were taught that. Behavior analysts aren't taught that for Ontario, for the Ontario market. And so I think that's something you're going to have to access in other ways.
And maybe I'll stay in Ontario for a little bit and ask Mary the same question. How does she recommend BCBAs learn about all these elements?
So, yeah, using all the resources available, which I'm sure Tracy knows more than I do, but I have spent a lot of hours on Google, and then what I find on Google, I try to run that by mentors that I have to see if what I'm finding is valid. So I've done a lot of that. I've spent a lot of time on, like, on TABA's reports on, you know, ethical billing and responsible qualifications of clinical supervisors. There was a lot of information in those reports that has been really helpful. And then also I've spent time, a lot of time on the ethics code and similar fields like the College of Psychologists. There's a lot of good information there that some of it is transferable. And then, I mean, I've been lucky because Discovery Center is affiliated with some other companies where there is an accountant and there's a practice administrator who has expertise in business. So I have had people available to me that I could bother a million times about questions, but I totally agree with Tracy about, like, taking a business course. Like, that's on my to-do list, to take an accounting course, because although we have an accountant, you know, stakeholders are asking me the questions, right? They're not going to the account, they're asking me, and I want to be able to give them knowledgeable answers and know how to read a P&L sheet and know how to read the bank balance and all the different, understand how payroll works and labor law works. So there is so much to learn, and yeah, it's a big undertaking. So, and then in terms of the clinical expertise, I would echo Tracy again and say that, you know, I still feel that I'm learning from the clinical mentors that I have, and I really strongly value the years I had under good clinical supervision at various agencies, regional providers, and private agencies, and then again in the community settings, because it's a different world than center-based. So, and then I would say get involved in, you know, community, you know, on TABA and all those kinds of conferences and that sort of thing are really helpful clinically.
And I love that you just said P&L, which I only know, definitely not from my training as behavior analyst or clinical psychologist, but because I ran my own company at one point as well. For those who don't know, it's a profit and loss statement. And you hope it's more about profit than loss at the end of the day. Kirsten, how about you? What would your sort of thought about, how do people go about learning what they need to learn?
So I think that the other two speakers gave some good suggestions. I had the fortune, sort of having a bit of a different background, because when I first started out in university, I thought that I'll just make a long story short. And I ended up at Seneca College, actually, in Toronto, taking accounting and finance. And so I had a little bit of that business background already. And then as an administrator in the autism programs at St. Amant, I spent a lot of time in government meetings, a lot of time working on proposals, working with HR, working with accounting, and all of those things. So kind of along the lines of what Tracy said, if you have the opportunity to work for somebody else, and you know, can develop a learning plan that includes wanting to learn those other things and having a role in those things, that's maybe an option. Outside of that, I think that the jurisprudence stuff is really, really important, and having a practice insurance of some kind that also gives you benefits of having those other professionals that you can speak to. So I'm licensed with an insurance company that has a plan that the Manitoba Psychological Society kind of sends out to everybody. So I already have within that liability, I have the ability to call and consult with a lawyer about any issue. Like all of those kinds of things are involved in that liability insurance plan. And even if there is no like BCBA jurisprudence, and I don't know if everyone knows what jurisprudence is exactly, because I didn't until I had to study for that exam to become a registered psychologist. But that's basically knowledge of all of the laws and regulations around your practice and the population that you're practicing with. And so I would just recommend looking at one of the other regulatory bodies, like the psychologists in Ontario or the speech paths or whatever it may be, and just get their resources. They have all the resources and links. Because really the jurisprudence exam is an open book exam for psychologists anyways, where you have to know where to find which laws and what information is applicable in it so that you would know if something came up. And especially when you're working with kids, there are a lot of ethical things that come up every single day that you had no idea to anticipate, and what to report, when to report. To the child protection agencies or things like that. So those things are really, really important. So I would be knowledgeable by using one of those other groups as kind of a template. And then private insurance, in terms of knowing the other insurers like Great West Life or whatever, like Blue Cross, there's a lot of issues around insurance and insurance reimbursement, and I didn't know how big a deal that was going to be until I started working in private practice, and how much of a different like all I lots and lots of clients, their first questions to me are, do you take Blue Cross or do you take this? And my answer is always no. I give you receipts and you can supply it to your insurance company for reimbursement. And that's maybe something that as an organized like that's a I think a bigger thing than just each individual person. That might be something Ontaba needs to advocate for. It might take going to individual insurance companies and educating them on what a BCBA is, but typically they don't like to reimburse anything that is not supported by a licensure or a regulatory body. So that has been a barrier for me in terms of getting my associates more clients, because they'd rather wait for me to have insurance reimbursement, even if it's going to be a few months, than to see my client or to see my associate who's available right away. So insurance reimbursement is a really big deal too.
That's helpful, Kirsten. That's a lot of great information. One thing I have to say is I'm really jealous. Your exam was open book. In Ontario, our jurisprudence exam for psychology is not open book. So had I known, I registered in the wrong province apparently. But I do appreciate what you said and a couple important things. Ontaba actually does have a jurisprudence committee. That I was voluntold into the chair position for, and we actually are pulling from psychology and speech language pathology and other regulated healthcare providers, and working on learning modules and an assessment or evaluation process. So that should be available in the coming months,
That's
year-ish.
great.
Yes, because I agree with you. It's a lot to learn and figure out, especially working in pediatric populations. So that's coming. And we also have our eye on the challenges that are presented to the field because behavior analysis is not regulated and or the practice is not, and therefore there are challenges with billing. I know that I have clients that are with me. I would like to think it's because of my brilliance, but I'm pretty sure it also is because I'm a psychologist and can be and they can apply for coverage through their insurance. So you've hit a couple of things that are actually really important in terms of learning, and ways to go about learning. But I also think you've identified a couple of really important barriers that exist for our field as well, so thank you. I'm just looking at the time. We probably have the opportunity for about two more rounds of questions. So I do want to ask one more, and then maybe we'll see if there's questions from the group that we have here. You can think about that. But one of the things I want to ask, I'm going to jump a few, so I'm just going to forewarn all of you that are here. What I would like to ask is, what do you recommend early career BCBAs do with regards to sort of establishing behavioral expertise when they're self-employed? What can people do to make that happen? And maybe I'll start with Mary beside me.
I kind of agree with Tracy that as new graduates and new BCBAs, it's best to get experience under a within another practice or another organization to really build your expertise, or at least like volunteering with someone who's an experienced clinical supervisor, or working closely with someone for a couple of years, or someone that you can convince to shadow you and give you advice, because yeah, when we're working with kids and vulnerable populations, especially our kids who are in IBI, they only have a certain amount of time, so we want to make sure that we're giving clinically appropriate programming and recommendations. So yeah, I think very strongly about working with a mentor for as long as you can.
Thank you. Tracy?
Yeah, I think if you're an early career BCBA and you want to actually get into this or there isn't a choice and you want to work in your career and so you're going to get into private practice, you have to somehow try and figure out early on how you're going to get your new competencies, right? You've got a scope of practice and you're going to practice within that, but then it's developing that competency. So it's attending conferences and workshops, webinars, really getting good podcasts, like getting good at finding those things that are free or very inexpensive. It's going to be pretty difficult, you know, if you're a brand new private practitioner trying to get to ABAI in the US. And, you know, really, it's about $3,500 to $4,000 if you want to go to that when you take everything into account. And so you're going to have to be more creative in how you get your knowledge. Develop or join a community of practice for sure, a peer support network. Even if it's a bunch of you all at the same level that can all relate, and then, you know, maybe get speakers in and things like that. You've got lots of mentors in the field in Ontario who are more than happy to mentor groups of people or individual people. Having a mentor, a clinical mentor and a business mentor should be high on your list, because that's what's going to get you through. I think the other thing, and it should be part of your business plan, but is decide if you're going to be a jack of all trades or if you're going to be a specialist or have a niche that you're going to do. There are many, many businesses already, providers already in private practice, all competing for the pediatric ABA space right now. And in business, this is called consolidation phase. So if you get into business long enough, you'll start learning. Every business goes through different phases. And what's happening right now means that within 1 to 2 years, there will only be a few big players left in the field. The government has forced us into that phase. It would naturally happen anyway, but I think we're there quicker because of what's happening. So you need to decide for yourself what's important to you, what you think, you know, maybe there's another area within BCBA, within behavior analysis that could be appealing to you that isn't. What's going on right now in pediatrics, things like that. But I think you're really, for yourself, going to have to look at that.
On that cheerful note,
I'm sorry.
I think that's a very, you've sort of slid that in there, this consolidation phase idea, which I'm not familiar with, but it demonstrates sort of an understanding of business and the field in a way that I think is probably important for everyone to get a sense of how much there is to know. Kirsten, how about you? How do you feel students, or I shouldn't say students, early career behavior analysts can continue to develop their skills while they're in private practice?
I do agree with everything that Tracy and Mary said already about at a minimum getting a part-time job with an established agency that has a supervision structure. I can't imagine fresh out of my master's me doing what I do now, and even fresh out of my PhD me, I think. Just the amount of benefit that came from working at an agency where I had all of those other resources at my disposal, and had somebody to, I had coworkers that I could go to with clinical things, and then there were also other, managers and supervisors that I could go to with things that were not, necessarily clinical in nature, but those overtake a lot of what you do. I mean, I ended up spending a lot of days working on, a CFS report. And that would t like reporting something to CFS had a lot of other steps to it. It had a bunch of phone calls. It had all these other things. And I learned a lot about the different kinds of things that come up that you don't know to know about. And a lot of things about, like, even little things like, how you should take clinical notes and what should go into your clinical notes and why it's dangerous not to have information in your clinical notes and what the legal ramifications if they get subpoenaed are and what you should like. There's all these little things that you really don't know to know until you're into the clinical practice. And so having those extra supports is absolutely beneficial, but also in terms of the PE, like PD, like Tracy was saying, attending conferences, networking, having a group of people that you can consult with. So even now that I've been in private practice for several years and I've been in the field for over 20, I still have my own mentors that I have established that I meet with for lunch kind of regularly, and I'll email them with questions and issues that I have. Because you there's always new things that come up that you didn't expect, or you just want to bounce off of somebody. So and learning to recognize limitations is really important. And also taking opportunities. Like, take every opportunity that you can to grow your behavioral skills and Tracy said you can either become the jack of all trades or kind of find a niche. And I went in the direction of diversifying because obviously, behavioral sleep strategies, for example, are beneficial for all kids, not just for kids with autism, or managing problem behaviors and doing a functional assessment or functional analysis and coming up with a match treatment plan is beneficial for all kids. Parent training is, you're going to use the same principles and procedures and things like that. So finding a way to broaden, I think, what you can offer was really beneficial for me, and so I would lean in that direction as well.
That's helpful. It's interesting to hear the different themes from this answer, much of which is about finding a network or developing a network and really staying connected to mentors, whether clinical or business. I'm going to ask if anyone has a question here in the room here. I have lots of head nods, no, and head shakes. So if that's the case, I'm going to ask a couple that are on here, but I want to add something to it. What was maybe one of the most significant challenges you experienced in private practice? And I also want you to share with us what your favorite thing about private practice is. And I don't think I've started with Kirsten in a while, so maybe I'll start with you, Kirsten, this time.
Okay, so biggest challenge and best thing. There's been a lot of challenges and barriers, so I was trying to just pick one. I think this is just common to practice in general, not common, like not just something that's in private practice. I experienced it every single day at St. Amant too, and that's having a difference in philosophy with other service providers or school staff or schools, and trying to help parents get the best support for their kids and manage the other sometimes quackery that is offered in a way that still seems like you're being collaborative. and that's a real balancing act. So, yeah, so that's a really big challenge, I find. And sometimes some of the policies from other institutions. So there are some school divisions that I've had no problems going, like I'll go into some of the schools and do observations and make recommendations and sometimes do some staff training. And then there are some school divisions here who have policies against external clinicians coming in. And so that's been a bit of a barrier sometimes too. The best thing is the flexibility. The flexibility in choosing my own hours. I have young kids, and my husband unexpectedly took over a family business, and his hours are really crazy. And so it's been a huge benefit to me, and to my family for me to be able to, just book days off when I need to and end my days early or go to doctor's appointments or take kids to appointments or different things like that without having to work around the regulations of an agency. And then flexibility to do what I think is right for the client and especially the biggest one, I think, I was in public services, I had to kind of toe the company line and kind of fight for the clients and the proper services in a way that I was restricted from saying what I really thought and what the evidence really showed. And in private practice, I don't feel, I mean, I still want people to like me and listen to what I have to say. And so I will still try to say it in a very nice way, but I don't hold back. And I let parents and other people know exactly where that evidence is and how to find it and what doesn't have any evidence. And so I really appreciate being able to be open and honest, I think, about those things.
That's great. That's helpful. Thank you. I'm going to turn over to Mary and ask her
Sure.
the same two things.
So I think the biggest challenge for me this year, in it being our first year of being open, is kind of opposite to what Kirsten just said in time. There is not enough time to do all the things that need to be done. It just has gotten worse over the year, not having enough time. Maybe someday there'll be more flexibility, but I don't foresee that anytime
You see the
soon.
difference between the new and then the somewhat more
Yes.
further along?
Yeah, and especially in this year with all of the government changes, that has made time worse and feeling really stretched between growing my own center and wanting to be involved in the activism side, which is so important, and trying to find some tiny semblance of balance also with your personal life and that sort of thing. So yeah, it's time has been the greatest challenge, and also managing all the changes with the government funding model. And then my favorite things are really, that those day-to-day little moments of this kid was just babbling, and now they said their first word, and it's just, that will never get old. And really having that opportunity to train ITs, and then they're the ones that get to be in the moment when little things like that hope happen. And I feel like teary thinking about it, but and also building relationships with all different people that I've met doing this and had the opportunity to learn from, and being and very honored to be invited to this. Like it's really been so wonderful, and makes me forget about not having any time. So yeah, all those things and training staff and having placement students come. I love that.
Excellent. And Tracy?
So I think there are some themes, that's for sure. For me, it was different. I mean, and I think it's different when you open a private practice and there's government funding that allow a lot of people to uptake quite significant hours. Like, we're still at pretty significant hours. Looking ahead to December, January, we don't know what it's going to really look like in the end. But it won't be what it is now. I think it's more going to be what Kirsten has in Central Canada. For me, when I started out in speech pathology, there was very little funding, very few people. People were not banging down my door either. So it was a slow start, and initially it was loneliness because I worked by myself. I went from a 32 speech pathologists at the school board to me, going to people's homes because I didn't want people in my own home. I didn't really want to do a center, an office. I was by myself all the time. I mean, I really looked forward to those private practice interest group meetings because I like desperately wanted colleagues. And I really found that I was really a collaborative person, that I did not like being that person who just went out and did assessments, you know, did some parent training or worked on articulation for a little bit. So loneliness was tough. The other thing that was tough when the business started growing and I did get a center for speech initially was that all those things that I thought I would never have to do again at the school board, like WMIS training and things like that, those policies and procedures, all came back. And now it was me. And now it was me that said, no, we have to have these forms and you have to do it this way and putting all those processes in place. And then the time crunch was bad from the beginning and has never let up. So never. Sorry, Mary. I mean, it's which 60 hours a week do you want to work? That's the flexibility, mm-hmm. right? So I think that was a challenge. The other one was realizing that I gave up, and my banker husband, bless his heart, he was my best supporter, but at times was so brutally honest. And, you know, he kept saying, you know, you could have had a pension. You could have had paid vacation days, paid sick days, and now you have none of that. And I think that was a real challenge. And I still, like, that's still a big challenge, is really when you're working by yourself, you have to really work enough. And there's been lots of research to show, you know, you have to work, you have to build 25 hours a week every week to be able to equal someone who has 2 weeks of paid vacation and some benefits and starts a pension plan. And if you're not doing that, you don't have those things. And so it, like, for me, those were really big things. And no, am I equal to my colleagues who stayed in a school board and have all retired now? Absolutely not. Never going to financially equal them, but would not have been happy staying there. So the best thing is I love what I do. My job is my hobby. I'm happy every single day doing it. I've got to go to really great places throughout the world to teach and to present, and I've met colleagues from all over the world. And I get to try and inform policy now at the government level and really look at what do we need to do for this field. And so I think for me, that has made up for all the other things.
That's excellent. It really is interesting to hear some of the common challenges, some of the challenges that maybe are a little bit different depending on how new you are into private practice, and some of the things that never seem to go away. I'm hearing time being the challenge, and I do appreciate the 60 hours a week. Which of those 60 hours, or when do you want to work those? Not that they go away necessarily, but you get to choose if you want to do them at 5 a.m. or if you want to do them at 11 p.m. and add them in or over your weekends. I think this has been really helpful for everybody. I see that we're creeping up to our hour-long time, so I will wrap things up. I didn't say this at the beginning, which I probably should have. I'm Dr. Julie Cowdis, and I'm an assistant professor at Brock University. I'm also in private practice and have been for, I guess, creeping up to a little bit over 5 years. So this has been really fabulous for me. I hope it's helpful to other people. I think you've demystified a little bit of the glamour of private practice, which I think is very important to do for anyone considering going out on their own. We really want behavior analysts in the province to be successful. We want them to provide adequate and exceptional services that are safe, that are consistent with the law and legislation. And I think you've really highlighted some of the steps that need the thinking and the steps that need to go into place
in order to make sure that people provide the quality of services that they, you know, were sort of dreaming of when they decided to embark on, you know, the easy peasy decision, as Kirsten said, of going into private practice. So thank you all.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks. So that is our conclusion. Thank you online, not online, the people who are now listening to this, and this would be a recording. So hopefully we'll be back with another, I feel like, episode at some point. And I didn't introduce myself. I'm Dr. Allison Cox. I'm also assistant professor at Brock University. And I have very high hopes for this. So thank you for listening. And we're going to press stop now.